Hola y bienvenidos al podcast Un gato en tierra de perros, vuestra referencia para la política estadounidense, la cultura y mucho más. Hello, I'm Joe Magaja. Thank you, friends, for being with me for another episode of Un Gato en Tierra de Perros. Today I have with me Ms. Elizabeth Barcoana. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me, Joe. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm fascinated with politics and local politics particularly. It seems like there's been a shift lately across the country and really across the world. For so long, the left has dominated everything, but it feels like a lot of people, even in Southern California, are kind of tired of things, tired of having to pay so many taxes, and the cost of living is so high. And then on top of that, we don't get much bang for our buck. We still have potholes everywhere, and the homeless issue just seems to be growing. How do you feel about the future in LA? Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic because definitely things are moving in our favor. As you know, I always say it shouldn't take so much death and destruction to make people real. The phrase is wake up, to make people wake up to what is going on and what the causes are. So it's first of all getting people to see what's in front of them, because not everybody sees it. Some people are more insulated from it. And the second is for them to understand that it's not climate change that's causing homelessness. It's not climate change that caused people's, you know, whole communities to burn down in the Palisades, but that it is poor leadership, bad decision making, and the wrong people are in charge. And that can be changed, which is the good news. And also, you know, I grew up in LA. California used to be a red state. Los Angeles used to have a Republican mayor when I was a little girl. We also had the longest running district attorney who was a Republican. His name is Steve Cooley. So things change in politics. You know, things can always, it was red before and it can be red again. Nothing is static in politics if you work at it. That's the key.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that I think it's good to have multiple parties, really. I think it's crazy.
Definitely.
That we have two parties to represent millions of people. And people have gotten so tribal that on, you know, especially the establishment, the traditionalists in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party, if you speak out of turn or say something where you disagree with someone in your own party, all of a sudden you're a traitor. Or just like people who are against the war in Ukraine, now all of a sudden they're considered Putin's puppets or whatever, when it's like, maybe I just have my own opinion. And maybe, you know, it used to be we were all kind of anti-war, and now it's different, you know. And then on top of that, you know, it seems like people are getting informed more by other sources, because the news is not really giving us information. You know, it kind of stopped after Vietnam, it seems like, and they figured out then that they needed to filter things a little more if they were going to be able to control us. So I don't know.
Yeah, there's definitely have been a lot of changes. So in California, you know, there is a very vibrant grassroots movement that has always existed. But because California is so big, and because the party is so powerful in terms of directing resources and what their endorsement means, especially, you know, for candidates, that it's been very difficult for the grassroots to kind of, you know, assert itself in any effective or meaningful way without working together with the party. We are meeting in Sacramento in March, in a few weeks, to elect a new leader of the California Republican Party. And without saying anything negative of prior leadership, because I think that, you know, there were certain things that they did very, very well. So I don't think that a 100% attitude of criticism is warranted. I will say that both candidates who are running to be the chair of the California Republican Party, which is the largest Republican party in the nation. So it's a very powerful and important position to the party nationally. Both of the people that are running understand the value that grassroots is bringing, and they want to incorporate them more into the formal party structure and give them more of a voice and give them, you know, more standing, so that it's not this constant establishment versus anti-establishment friction that's happening within the Republican Party, which you saw at a national level with Donald Trump when they got rid of the head of the RNC when he became the nominee and all of that. I mean, that's very typical at the state level too. So I think it's a positive thing that both candidates of the new leadership recognize that it's time to try and resolve that internal friction so that we can all turn our guns on the opposition and not on each other.
Yeah, for sure. What are your thoughts on DOGE and what's taking place on a national level?
I mean, every day is like Christmas around here. Yeah. We just love it. I just love it. I think the people really love it because we all kind of knew that, like, the math is just not adding up, especially people who like live in the real world and work in the private sector. Like, when you see what things cost and what you get for it, you know that like money is being wasted. There's no, even without looking at the books, you know that there's something wrong. Like, for example, in California, they've lost track of $24 billion that was supposed to go into, you know, improving homelessness, and homelessness got worse, even though we keep spending more money on it, even though we keep raising taxes on ourselves to reduce it. It keeps getting worse. And why is that? Because the incentives are wrong. There is the homeless industrial complex, where they get paid basically for how much services they're providing to the homeless. They're not getting paid based on how the reduction in the homelessness population. They're not getting paid based on outcome, like how many people are getting clean on their program, how many people are getting jobs. Like, they're not getting paid that way. They're getting paid to serve the homelessness, which only incentivizes more homelessness for the people who are looking for free services and the people who are providing them, because the government just keeps pumping money into their contracts. So that's a long way of answering the question of, you know, there is waste, fraud, and abuse everywhere, that the American people instinctively knew that. And it's very validating for the American public to see that we were right. And not only were we right, but the types of ridiculous spending that has been going on, not only in the United States, but all around the world. We were exporting these ridiculous, far left, radical ideas, and the United States government was funding them, because otherwise it's a manufactured demand for, you know, these random gender like gender theory driven initiatives. There isn't as much of a demand for that, so they manufacture it by creating the demand, by creating these events and workshops and things like that. It's not real, and it's a huge waste of money, and it's disruptive to the countries that we're going into, you know, feeding them with this socialism that is, you know, that everyone who has lived under socialist governments, especially in the, you know, Spanish speaking world, knows that it brings misery, poverty. You know, it's not, it does not drive freedom, does not drive economic prosperity. It's not good. And it's so backwards that the United States has been pushing that out to the outside world rather than democracy, freedom, you know, freedom of religion, all of those real fundamental values, the Judeo-Christian values that our country was founded on, that so many people all around the world share. Instead of exporting that, we were paying for this crazy stuff that destabilizes the social fabric of the entire world. So to see that exposed so early on in the administration and so simply with like some young kids who are really good at coding, like just, you know, disrupted everything. And it was beautiful to watch. And I'm loving watching it every single day.
I agree. And I think that, I mean, the opposition is kind of showing how nasty they are by doing things like trying to dox these kids. And these kids are just doing their job and they're doing a very good job, or belittling them and saying, oh, they're just kids. You know, when if the shoe was on the other foot, they'd be like, you people are bullying these kids, you know. So it's all just fake outrage. You know, it drives me crazy. And yeah. USAID, I mean, not only were they pushing these programs, but I think in many countries, they were withholding aid unless they instilled these programs as well. So it's like,
of course, that's what I'm talking about. It's like a manufactured demand. They had to force it because those countries didn't want that. Countries don't want drag queen story hour in their Catholic countries. Everyone knows that. So they have to force it, and they do that in America too. That's how they get their agenda across. You said right before you said they accuse you of things that, you know, if the shoe were on the other foot, they would never. But today, as I was waiting to come on with you, I saw a Democrat was in front of a crowd. She was speaking at some rally, and she said that Elon Musk, who's an American citizen, should go back to where he came from. Should go back to South Africa.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And, I mean, you do hear that on both sides. But I mean, I'm a conservative. I'm an American citizen. If you're an American citizen, you are an American. This is your home. There's no other home for you. And to say that to somebody is just so disgusting. And it shows, like, they think that they, you know, they hold themselves up to be the party that protects the immigrant. But that's not the case. What they really are doing is they are attracting an immigrant population that is vulnerable because they're new to the country, and they exploit them by keeping control over them. That is what the Democrat Party has been doing for 100 years. It is not new. And they do it with every immigrant population.
Yeah, it's they always say, well, you wouldn't be able to survive without illegal immigrants. But basically, we're taking advantage of them. And the reason folks are okay with it is because they work for a lower wage than any American would work, but it's practically starvation wages. So we're keeping people enslaved basically, to a certain extent. And how is that okay? You know, basically, I guess what they're saying is, well, their kids will be born here and then the next generation will be able to move up. But basically, they're going to have to live a life in poverty because that supports our economy. It doesn't really make sense. And I mean, I believe in immigration. I believe anybody should be able to immigrate to any country if they want to, but legally, you know, because we don't want criminals coming across. And there's been a lot of problems with that. How did you end up getting into politics, by the way? I'm sorry to shift, but.
No, that's great. But just to go back to your point before I answer your question, it made me think of something. It's not only exploiting them once they get here. The process of bringing, of saying, come on over, our border is open, is exploitative as well, because the cartels have been unbelievably enriched since the Biden, you know, in those 4 years of the Biden administration, from the human trafficking and women assaulted, children assaulted, separated from their families, abandoned at the border. You remember that little boy that was just dropped over the wall? I mean, by opening the border like that, they opened the gateways to that as well. And when you don't have order, you can't keep families safe coming over. So, okay, so how did I get involved in politics? So I, like I said, I grew up in Los Angeles. I am from a very traditional conservative family, but we weren't so politically active. Our, you know, my parents supported a lot of organizations that had a lot to do with Israel. And so that also touched in a little bit of politics as well. My dad was one of the founders of the Republican Jewish Coalition of their Western region. So I grew up hearing a lot. And then the first election that I ever voted in was right after 9/11. And so that was George Bush's second term. And so I've always voted for a Republican president, and I grew up in a conservative household. But I was never active in politics other than being a voter and, like, kind of, you know, paying attention a little bit to some issues. And it wasn't until 2020, during the pandemic, when the schools were closed, but then BLM was allowed to, you know, take over our cities, burn them down, loot them. They were allowed to do whatever they want. The cops were, you know, standing down and not doing anything about it. But my kids couldn't go to school. And that was it for me. I mean, and then at the same time, the California Teachers Union was making crazy demands that had nothing to do with COVID, in order to agree to go back to work for the following fall, which of course we know they didn't. So that's when I really started getting involved in California politics. And I would, most of what I started to do was on social media, and I basically was teaching myself and then talking about it on social media to teach my friends as well about what was going on, how a lot of the things were politically driven, because most people didn't understand that. A lot of people just accepted that this is what it's a pandemic, it's unprecedented, social distancing, you know, wait for the vaccine, wear a mask, all of that stuff. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You know, nowhere around the world was making kids under 6 years old wear masks, but in America, it was required at 2 years old. So, like, as if COVID is different in America than it was in the rest of the country. Like, there were so many things that didn't make any logical sense to me. And then, of course, I also recognized a lot of, like, totalitarian tactics that they were using about, like, trying to get people to rat each other out, or, you know, basically people turning against each other. And I knew just from not only my education, but, you know, my mom fled an Islamic regime. And so I am very sensitive, also being Jewish. Like, I just have a knowledge and understanding of these things, and I was recognizing it and what was going on all around us. So I was talking about that and kind of teaching people about that. And I was teaching people about how, you know, systemic racism is not a real thing, and what the statistics are and what they're claiming, like, also doesn't make any sense, and things like that. So I just, little by little, you know, because there was so much to deal with, we had to get the schools opened, which we did. Once we got the schools opened at the state level, we had to deal with the county taking the masks off the kids. And then we had to deal with Gavin Newsom announcing a vaccine mandate to start kindergarten, which is the age that my kids were at that time. So there was a lot to do for like a couple of years. And I was very involved, like basically just the moms, you know, we had, none of us really had ever been active in politics, but we figured it out and we became organized and loud and we learned who to call and who was voting what way when these things came up for votes in the legislature. You know, we were paying attention to that. And at the same time, I was like, hey, guys, do you notice that it's the Democrats that are doing all of this and that the Democrats are only voting one way? And the Republicans are not, like, I was also, you know, ringing those bells. So in 2022, so every 2 years we have elections in the United States. Those are our main elections. So in 2022 was the first election after the pandemic. And I'm thinking, like, of course, all the parents are going to rush to the polls and we're all going to vote Republican and Gavin Newsom is going to get recalled. And, you know, there was all this. I was so hopeful and optimistic in 2022. And then we just got completely killed, like murdered. Not even, you know, not one parent. A lot of parents ran for office in that election year, and not one of them made it through. And this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning with the California Republican Party. And this is when that was the election that I learned that in California, at least, you know, maybe if you're Donald Trump, you can run as an outsider and win. But in California, at least, you need to run from within the party infrastructure. There is no other way to get through the primary. So we lost, all the parents lost the primary, and then there was no red wave that we were promised at a national level that year. And it was just very bad. So at that point is when I realized that, like I said, you need to get involved at the party level. And so I showed up to, I started calling people that I found that, you know, we had connections to that had been involved in the California Republican Party. And I got invited to a meeting. It was an open meeting in November of 2023. And I stuck around at the end and introduced myself to the chairman of the county party. And he said, hey, you want to run for central committee? And I was like, sure, what's that? I didn't know what I was agreeing to. But he made it sound very, very simple and easy. And of course, it wasn't. But I got myself elected the way that we're organized in LA County, because we're so big. Again, we're the biggest Republican county party in the nation, not just in California, but in the nation. We are seven person committees, organized by state assembly district. So California has 80 assembly districts, about 24 or 25 of them, can't remember off the top of my head, are located within Los Angeles County. And each one of those districts has a seven person committee that's elected by the other Republicans in that district. So we had the most competitive race in all the districts. There were, I think, 11 or 12 people running, and the top seven win. So I had to like campaign, and seven of us formed a slate, and we won. So that's how I got elected into the party. And then, you know, I just kind of worked my way in. And now I am a full delegate to the California Republican Party as well.
So wonderful. Well,
that's where I'm at.
you're so well spoken. What was your background before this?
I mean, oh, I appreciate that. I'm an attorney.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yes, I'm an attorney. I'm a litigator. So the skills of persuasion, of public speaking, of making logical arguments. Socratic method also is very helpful, especially talking to entrenched, you know, Democrats who had never even been exposed to the other side of the argument of these issues that they think they believe so strongly in. But once you start asking them some questions, like, it all just, you know, you
falls
can
apart.
Very easily. So all of that background, plus, you know, that's my skill set, but my drive comes from the fact that I'm a mother, and we, our roots are here. My husband and I both grew up here from young ages. We have four children who we want to grow up here. You know, both their grandparents all live here. Our brothers and sisters live here. We're not all picking up and uprooting ourselves somewhere else. We are staying. And I also believe that if you don't oppose, whether it's evil or bad ideas, however you want to characterize it, if you don't oppose and resist it, it grows stronger and it spreads, and there becomes nowhere else to go. And so I think that California is the front for the rest of America. I think it's a very, very, very important state. I understand people who can move, they do. I understand why they do. But we decided not to, and I have no choice. I have an inner calling that I have to do this. I think about it in my sleep because it's the future for my children. I think that's really where it comes from.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. I've lived in California since I was four, in LA County for the most part. My family's all over the place, and I have friends, because I partly went to school in Europe. I was born in Spain, and I went to high school in Spain, and friends of mine from there are like, why don't you move away? Because it's so expensive, you know, and you can get a lot more, you can live a lot better in some other places for a lot cheaper. But yeah, I do love it here. The weather and everything else. And one thing that we used to have, which seems to be dying, which is Hollywood, which I'm sure, I don't know if you watched the Oscars yesterday, but it's not what it used to be. I think people don't even watch the Oscars anymore or care, and they're not interested in the glamorous lives of actors and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, it used to be like an escape from your own life, but like the problems that we have are so fundamental that like watching them perform this glitzy, glamorous, like, it's so out of touch from what most Americans are going through. It doesn't feel to me anymore. It doesn't feel like this escape. It feels just like watching a bunch of out of touch. And maybe it's because they get so political. Maybe if they just stayed in their lane and stayed as entertainers, you wouldn't feel this. I wouldn't feel this way so strongly. But it's a bunch of people, a room full of people who have donated millions and millions of dollars to these political parties and organizations that are destroying our country and our state and our city. And a lot of them are insulated from it because of their lifestyle and their wealth and the industry that they're in. You just can't respect it. And so you can't enjoy really watching them. That's how I feel. Anyway, yeah. People feel similarly.
I think so, because I mean, if you look at the movie theaters have been dying for years. Even before COVID, people weren't going out as much to movie theaters because of streaming and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I write screenplays, and I have a lot of friends in the industry that have moved to other industries or moved to other states because it's just not, you know, now when I go to, if I go to parties in Hollywood, or in, by Hollywood, I mean anywhere in LA where they're in the industry. And I talk to people, it's always the same thing. They say, well, we thought it was going to get better after COVID, but the jobs just aren't there, and it's not looking good. So, and that was a big economy driver for Southern California as well.
Yeah. So it was a big base of political power as well for Southern California. So it's definitely a problem. Sacramento knows it's a problem because I'll tell you what, we were in a meeting. So I'm also on the board of our neighborhood council meeting. Neighborhood council is an advisory board to the city of LA. There's 99 of them, and they serve in advisory capacity to the LA City Council and the mayor. So a lot of times elected officials will come and they'll like talk to us. They'll give us reports and updates and things like that. So one of them goes, you know, we know that Hollywood and, you know, the film industry is on everybody's minds. And, you know, we're working on like a tax incentive bill and legislation to keep it here. And I was like, well, you know, actually, this is before the fires. I was like, you know, actually, what's on everybody's mind? I was like, thank you for that. what about the fact that nobody can get homeowners insurance or fire insurance in California? That's actually what's on everybody's minds. You know, they're looking at this narrow, it's an important industry in Southern California, but it's a relatively small subset of people that you're dealing with when there are so many issues that touch every single Californian that they're not addressing at all. This is actually typical of the Democrat Party, where they'll like, you can do something that's going to have an impact, like this big of an impact on, you know, on everybody, but like they'll look at the thing that has like this big of an impact and they'll focus on that, like this 99, you know, this 1% of the problem, they're going to focus on that and ignore the 99% that can be addressed with good policy. It also like was a balance to Silicon Valley to have, you know, Hollywood as a center of power, but they did it to themselves. You know, I don't really feel that bad for them. They
didn't adapt to the shifting changes in the industry, which they never do, especially most industries didn't adapt to the internet when it came along. They thought it was a passing phase and they'd still be able to just do brick and mortar. And look how retail has gone downhill with Amazon, and Amazon boomed throughout the pandemic, particularly because, you know, nobody was leaving their house, you know? Yeah,
of course.
But, the fires, I know that they keep going back and forth on how long it's going to take to rebuild. Do you think that people are going to be able to rebuild, or do you think that, people are going to buy, or companies are going to buy the land and make like condos or that kind of thing, or?
Nobody knows. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows. It's still way early to tell. In terms of rezoning and building condos where there used to be single family residences, you have to remember that like a lot of places in LA, like, you know, the traffic in LA, right? A lot of places in LA are not able to accommodate the infrastructure, the roads, the, you know, the schools, the sewers, the electricity grid. Like the infrastructure is not built to accommodate a higher density of zoning, of homes, of housing. So it doesn't make sense. And it's also dangerous because you can't evacuate, you know, four times the amount of people on the same roads that you had from before. So that's going to be a huge, huge fight about how to accommodate the housing needs that the city has in the rebuilding process in a safe way. And also that, you know, preserves the character of those communities from before the fires, which I think a lot of people prefer, but also how to rebuild it in a cost-effective way that makes sense. So we have, you know, it's not the reason that California is so expensive is because we have regulations here that no other state has. We also have high gas prices, which increases the cost of everything, because in order to get it anywhere, you know, the transport costs more. And And then on top of that, we have very, very strong labor unions, and they negotiate very high labor costs. So it can be done, but the laws have to change, and like the way things are done have to change. And this was true before the fires, because it is true that we have a housing shortage to keep up with our population in Los Angeles. But the reason that there is a housing shortage is because the city and the state have this stranglehold on developers' abilities to build a lot and fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It takes too long, and you have to, it's a business. Like, they're entitled to make a profit. Mm-hmm. If people want to sell their property and make a profit, like, they should be able to. If a developer wants to buy the property from them right now and they'll go, you know, move to Newport Beach, like, they should be able to. It's a free market economy. But what really throws things off is the government's overregulation that makes, you know, it's not an organic free market, you know, exchange. Like, the government is messing with it and making it, of course, more expensive. So what I think is going to happen, because these are deep, deep blue areas of LA County where these fires were, I think that, and it's already started to happen, where Newsom is, like, you know, waiving as much of the regulations as he can. Mm-hmm. So CEQA is one of them. It's one of our, you know, it's a monster environmental regulation, but it's so open-ended and so, you know, like, anything is CEQA. Like, you can make a CEQA argument for anything. And as a result of that, it ties a lot of developments up in litigation, or, you know, the permitting process becomes more difficult or expensive. So I suspected this is what he was always going to do, because he wants to accommodate the people who live in these areas, because those are his voters. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to make it as easy as possible.
And where are they? Are they living in hotels, or have they left the area?
It's a combination. I know people that were in hotels long term, or they were in rentals, and they have, you know, insurance that's covering the cost of those things. I don't know for how long that's going to be. And I'm not sure anybody knows the answers to these questions yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering, like you said, if maybe a lot of people will just end up moving down to Newport Beach. I thought possibly, because it wasn't all rich people, the Palisades people were wealthy, but then of course there's also Altadena,
right,
where there was a big middle and lower income community, a Black community that had been there for a long time. And I'm wondering if they might end up in my area in the Inland Empire, because it's just affordable, just because it's really hard to rebuild when a lot of people who have inherited houses can't afford to live out there if they had to start over, you know.
It's horrible. It's devastating what happens to Los Angeles in January. And the impacts of that, you know, just can't be overstated, the long-term impacts of what it's going to do to the population and those communities. And, you know, it also has a lot to do with whether the schools are open. Like, the schools are not open over, I know the Palisades better because it's my district, and it's close to where I live. I don't know what's going on with the schools in Altadena, but I know that in the Palisades, like, kids can't go to school. So if your kids can't go to school in person, like, if you can move, you're going to move.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I know Rick Caruso, well, he was able to protect some of his properties with private firefighters. And now they've passed some ordinances where they say the private firefighters can't have access to public water. But from what he said, they weren't using public water anyway.
Yeah. I think people were accusing him of that. And then this was like, and he wasn't. And so this was kind of the city. This was like a PR move, I think, more than anything, to make people sure that, like, you know, nobody's going to let anyone do that, regardless of whether he was doing it or not.
And I know the the fire chief was fired by Karen Bass, and she had a hearing, I think, was that last night as well?
I know that she was supposed to have one. I think it was supposed to be Friday, and then I don't know what happened. I haven't seen the news on that one in particular. But yeah, she had said that she didn't want to. Karen Bass's version of the story was she wasn't going to cooperate with some type of investigation or something like that, which I'm not sure if that's true. I don't know. I didn't follow this one as closely. And that was the basis on which she fired her. But we all know it was kind of more than that, because
yeah, it was basically,
she was a troublemaker.
Which anybody who speaks out seems to get the foot on the neck these days. Yeah. What do you think Karen Bass's future in LA is? Do you think she has one?
She, so she used to be a member of Congress, and then she ran for mayor. She ran against Rick Caruso. She was the progressive choice against a more moderate choice. And she won. And a lot of people couldn't believe that she won, because Caruso's campaign had so much energy behind it. But I think it was a testament to how strong the progressive Democrat machine is in Los Angeles. And if your listeners and viewers don't know what that means, like, a progressive Democrat basically means a communist. They believe in Marxist ideas. They talk like communists as well. They call each other comrades. Like, there is a Democrat Socialist Party of America. It's not me using a pejorative to describe them. They themselves call themselves, you know, Marxists and communists and socialists, and they're proud of it. And they're machine, they're very connected to the unions, so they have the manpower, the infrastructure, the organizing infrastructure, and the money to fund, you know, whatever candidate that they want. And she was their pick, Karen Bass.
Yeah.
Now, we don't know, you know, how she's handled police and fire and building and stuff like that. I mean, she's made a lot of people really upset. And it's a question whether those, you know, organized political activists will stand behind her or not. That's kind of what happened with George Gascon, the district attorney. He was also supported by the same kind of groups. And then he, when he was running for re-election, the money and the support didn't show up for him. So it remains to be seen whether they're going to stand by her. She is running for re-election. You know, there is a recall effort for her. We're almost there at 2026. We're waiting to see who is going to run to challenge her.
So, you think Rick will run again, or?
It's the talk of the town. what he's going to run for, if he's going to run for governor, or if he's going to run for mayor. I would like to see a very strong conservative running for mayor of LA. I don't know if that's in the cards for 2026, but I definitely know that Karen Bass has to go. She really should have resigned the day that she got back from Ghana. People died. People, it wasn't only just people who lost their homes. That was just a colossal failure, and she should have resigned in shame. But they have no shame, unfortunately. So it would have taken someone else to force her to resign. And no such person did that. Gavin Newsom came down to LA and he was here for weeks and was acting like the de facto mayor to kind of, you know, rehabilitate himself. I don't think he was doing it to help her, but it also kind of made her look very weak that he was having to come down here and do her work for her. So I think that even people on the furthest left would look to an alternative, especially after the fires.
Yeah. And Gavin Newsom obviously had aspirations to be the president. And I don't know. I think he's completely blown at this point, but you never know. They seem to be open to voting for people that don't even have clear principles or policies, you know?
Yeah. I posted about this on X today, actually. I think that it's a mistake to be overly optimistic that Gavin Newsom's presidential hopes for 2028 are officially dead. I don't think that at all whatsoever, because just from what we know about the past however many years he's been governor, like, he has survived fiasco after fiasco, like, running the gamut, you know, from government corruption to cheating on his wife to, you know, putting his kids in private school and, you know, in-person school while all our kids weren't allowed to go to school. Mm-hmm. Like
French Laundry. Yeah.
French Laundry. Like, he wasn't recalled. Just thing after thing, he survived in California. Now, whether the rest of the country has an appetite for him is another story, but they love Nancy Pelosi. She's from California. She's from the same ilk as him. You know, the
same family too, kind of, right? Aren't they related in some way?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. They are related. Kamala Harris, you know, they voted, all of the Democrats, like, they voted for her. But before she became the candidate, they were running a corpse, and everybody was like, this guy is great. You know, he's going to save democracy. And they were defending him, and they were running a dead person almost, who couldn't put a sentence together, who couldn't, you know, get through a day. Mm-hmm. So the point of that is, it doesn't matter how much we hate Gavin Newsom, the machine can prop up anyone or anything. And that is why it's important for people to stay engaged for 2026. You know, Donald Trump is not going to be on the ballot. It's not a presidential election, but 2026 is going to be a turning point. Just like 2024 was a turning point for the nation, 2026 is going to be a turning point for California. So, you know, we have about a year and a half until the primary in California. And this is the time right now for everyone to start figuring out what their role is going to be in helping bring change to California. So the role that I have taken on is, I've identified that there are about 500,000 people in Los Angeles County who are not registered Republicans, but voted for Donald Trump in 2024. And my goal is to reach out to all of those people and to educate them about why it's important for them to re-register as Republicans and what that would do to the map in California in terms of, you know, helping move the needle to the right. How that would help in with ballot initiatives, with statewide elections, with certain districts that are close. You know, we have several 50-50 races in California. It's not not every race is 60-40 like the presidential race was. So that's my goal. And I hope that through that initiative, I will increase the size of the Republican Party in Los Angeles. We're already the biggest, but I want to be even bigger. I want to capitalize on all of that potential that Donald Trump created for us. So I don't have to flip a Democrat to become a Republican, because Donald Trump already did that for me in 2024. All I have to convince them is why it's important that they re-register. And the reasons for that are it allows the Republican Party to find you and to communicate with you and for their candidates to campaign to you without having to, you know, search through all the Democrats, you know, all the 3 million Democrats in Los Angeles County. We can find only the Republicans because it is a fact that they have more resources than we do. So we are limited and we have to be more resourceful in how we do that. And so we can't yet, you know, blanket everyone or all the Democrats just to find our Republican voters within you. So one is you become more accessible and communication becomes easier. And then we could use that money for something else that will actually, you know, help turn out voters and things like that. And the other reason is, and this is something I learned as I became part of the Republican Party, the very, very first data point that a potential candidate or a potential donor or, you know, anybody in that is a political strategist, the first data point that they look at is the difference between the registered Republicans and the registered Democrats in a given geographic district. So whether that's Congress or California Assembly or statewide, the first data point they look at is the difference. They do not account for independents in that analysis. They only look at one versus the other. And if that number is very far away, they move on. They don't even think to put a cent of resources into that district or time into finding a good candidate. You guys are all on your own until those numbers become closer, and then you make yourself like a competitive or swing, even a swing district. So like the best comparison I can give most people are like in the national elections, we have swing states, right? Mm-hmm. So all the money and emphasis was in those seven swing states, right? Mm-hmm. That's where they were sending their money. That's where there's everyone was organizing. That's where Scott Pressler was. That's you know, where the volunteers were going to. So those were swing states because the difference between Democrats and Republicans in those states is very, very small. Mm-hmm. California and even Los Angeles County has swing districts where we have very close numbers between, you know, Republicans and Democrats. So if we increase the numbers of the Republicans in those districts, and also we maintain our relatively good but could be improved voter turnout once you get to election time, you're going to see a lot of improvement. So there's a lot of potential there when you fix that very first data point that they look at, when you make those numbers closer together, when you make it harder for the strategist to ignore you, you know, even if you have a really good candidate who's very talented, which, by the way, it's hard to attract one if they're just going to lose in the first place. But if you have attracted, if you're lucky enough to have a really good candidate, you still need the money. Like the money still needs to come in. So our closest district in LA County is Assembly District 40. Great candidate. We lost that last election by just 522 votes. So it was definitely an attainable, you know, seat to flip back Republican. But the Democrats put $4.5 million into that race, which typically you get like 1 million, 2 million at the most, like 4.5 million. I don't know if it was unprecedented, but it's very unusual. It's a lot of money for one of those kind of races. And he, you know, he couldn't compete with that. With those type of resources, you just can't get your message out there to enough people the way they can. And so that's why voter registration is important, especially in that area. If we can like get more Republicans, then it makes things more efficient. Mm-hmm. And also like more movement will happen there.
That sounds good. That's great. What are your thoughts on the Libertarian Party? Do you feel they're pulling away from the Republicans in terms of pulling voters away from voting Republican or possibly towards Republican votes?
There's a lot of viewpoints of the Libertarian Party that most Republicans agree with. Did you see the Libertarian Convention?
I don't know if it was the Libertarian. I saw the one that Trump went to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they booed him. I know they booed him. But
so
I think
they elected as the chair of their party, like a Harris supporter who like wears a mask or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think as principles, the Libertarian point of view has a lot to offer. But in terms of a political party, not. You know, we are a two-party system in the United States of America. That's how we were set up to be. We're not a parliamentary system where you're, you know, making deals with to build a coalition. That's not America. You have to build your coalition within either the Republican or the Democrat party. And it used to be that they were pretty close, but now it's like night and day, life and death, freedom and Marxism. Like there is, it's so different. It's so easy to identify which one, you know, you belong. And then you build your coalitions from within that.
Yeah. It used to be that members of Congress on the left and right were all friends. And I mean, they would fight fiercely during the day, but then they would be going out to drinks or dinner together at night sometimes, you know. They weren't always brutal enemies, you know, and I think that it's gotten so tribal now. There's got to be some way to fix that divide, because we're all Americans, and it's really sad. Some people have stopped talking to relatives that voted one way or, you know, and I think that's insane. It's your blood. Yeah. How can you turn your back on your family or friends, childhood friends? You know, it's ridiculous, I think, you know.
Yeah, no, totally. Most of my friends stopped talking to me in 2020. So thankfully now my family is pretty, for the most part, we are like-minded. You know, it's very bad. And to be honest, it usually only goes one way. It's usually one side not talking to the other. And it's unfortunate, but like you said, you know, we all are Americans, and that used to, when you said that, that used to mean the same thing to everyone. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't now. And that's a really huge problem. And the root of that is the destruction of the American nuclear family and the destruction of the education system. And that's been going on for a couple of decades at least. So it's going to take us more than one election cycle to fix it. But the good news is there's a lot of soldiers on board and a lot of people who are willing to help and who want to help.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much, Elizabeth, for coming on. Where can people find you? On the internet or in person?
Yeah. So I have a website, elizabethbarkohana.com, that talks about, you know, things that I've been doing and working on. And I also am very active on X. My handle is @E_Barkohana. My last name is BARKOHANA.
What is that, by the way? Is that Mexican or?
No, it's Persian, and it's
Persian,
Jewish.
Okay.
Yeah, it's you know, the last name Cohen. It's
yes.
it's like a version.
Oh, like Bar, like Ben or Bar. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm Jewish too. I actually spent a year in Israel right out of high school. But go ahead,
nice.
Keep on telling you. Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, my family is, my husband is Iranian, and my mom is Iranian. My dad is not. So,
okay. Yeah, because you have the more Sephardic looks, you know, you don't look Ashkenazic. You look more like, Persian.
It makes sense.
Yeah. Do you speak Farsi?
No. So my mom Came here when she was 16 and met my dad almost immediately, and they were married by the time she was 19. And the reason I say that is because she was still like learning English herself, like getting proficient in English, which she speaks flawlessly with no accent. She didn't really speak to me in Farsi in front of my dad because he didn't understand what we were saying. So I grew up hearing it, like my grandparents speaking it and stuff like that. But I don't, unfortunately, speak it very well. I can kind of follow a conversation and I know some words, but no, not me.
I learned a good amount. My best friend in Spain in high school was from Iran. It was right after the revolution. So I was teaching him English and he was teaching me Farsi. And then when I moved back here, every time I met a Persian person, I'd ask if they knew him, you know, and he has a very different name. But no, and then finally I did find him and we're in contact again, you know, but
That's so
I would
cool.
always blow them away because, you know, I'd find out someone was from Iran. And I mean, I guess in West LA, it's not strange to hear somebody speaking in Farsi, but
yeah, it's
in,
a big
in the Inland Empire, if you say like Halet Khube or Halet Tetore, people are like,
very good.
Yeah, very cool. Well, thank you again. Is there any other place that people can find you or that they should look for you?
Instagram is the other one. I know some people prefer one or the other. I'm also on Instagram at Elizabeth from California. And so anytime I have, you know, I attend or host an event or something like that, I post them there. So anybody who's in LA that wants to get involved, please reach out to me, follow along with me on social media, because I'm always posting like things that people can be doing and different ideas.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thanks again. And thanks to all our listeners and until next time.
Yes. Thank you.